Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. I'm your host, Adam Horner. With 30 years in the industry, including over a decade as a CTO, I've coached and mentored hundreds of engineers and tech leaders. In today's episode, we're exploring one of the most crucial topics for any tech leader preparing for a funding round or M&A transaction. I'm speaking with Torger Einarsson, a seasoned CEO and advisor who's helped hundreds of tech startups across the globe raise capital and navigate acquisitions over the last 35 years. Torger shares his personal journey, including how the dot-com boom affected his approach to fundraising. And together, we talk through a practical playbook for CTOs preparing for their next major deal. We explore the crucial role that CTO plays, from securing technical due diligence to selling the future vision of the technology, and how even a misstep in this process can make or break a deal. You'll also learn how to avoid common mistakes, like underestimating your impact or falling into the not invented here trap, and how to communicate your tech strategy with confidence. If you're a CTO approaching a major funding round or acquisition, this episode will leave you feeling prepared, informed, and ready to lead your company through the process. Torger, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us on the CTO Playbook. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Adam. I'm really looking forward to it.
Good, good. Well, you've had a long career and a really, really fun one. And I mean, you've been raising money for quite a long time. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you actually got into raising money for businesses in the first place?
Yeah, well, I've probably been doing this for longer than I'd like to admit. So, but I think it really started when I spent time in Silicon Valley back in the late 90s. And that, of course, is also known as the dot-com boom and bust. And so that's really where I started raising capital for my own companies. Before that, I actually ran companies bootstrapped, which is also a good thing to do. But then I understand kind of the playbook for, you know, how to raise some money and how venture capital worked. And after that, selling my companies and so on, I ended up being asked by a lot of startups, you know, if I can help them with strategy and so on. But mostly all of them wanted to have help with raising capital. How do we do it?
So what was your first deal? Can you remember your first deal?
Well, it was my own company, actually. We were a company called Category Software in London. And we had, back in the day, that was 1998. And VC wasn't that known back then. And we pitched to a number of companies and we raised £1 million for, we had products, we had customers, but things have changed a lot since then. I mean, I think we probably wouldn't today have raised money, you know, with the same kind of pitch that we had then. We were kind of charming. And I would have ran a company at that time that already had, I don't know, $10, $15 million in revenue. So it's kind of like raising the back of what I've done in the past.
Yeah. I know. And also that stage, I think VC was quite a pocket industry at that stage, wasn't it? It was very much sort of a rounding error on the large funds in terms of what they side money off to.
Yeah. I mean, it was more like private equity back then. And VC was kind of thing that, I mean, it was around the same time as the first real tech IPO happened called Netscape. It wasn't seen before that you can actually take a company public for so many billions in valuation that hadn't turned a profit. It was a new thing. And of course, it was everything about the internet, right? So it's going to change everything. And it has changed everything. So it was right. Now, we wrote software and we were also very early with mobile and all those sort of things. But yes, we raised that round and then we raised another 4 or 5 times. And as I said, we went through the whole dot-com boom and bust. We saw things change really, really quickly. And of course, since then, we've seen that happen another 3 or 4 times. So, you know, the movie kind of repeats itself.
The big cycle keeps going around, right? So you must have seen some great deals in that time, but also some deals that kind of went sideways.
Yeah, I think in most cases, I would say that good companies and good founders will always, you know, succeed in a way. And depending on how you define success, but I think also good founders, you know, realize that maybe this idea isn't the best idea. I should start something else. But I think when you fail, I think is when you are not kind of honest with yourself that maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe I should be doing something else. I mean, I have seen some deals collapse because of real kind of shoot yourself in the foot kind of thing.
And that sounds like something's worth saying.
Yeah, it does happen. But I think personally, I haven't been involved in so many deals that haven't really worked out. I think it's been more in situations where I've seen companies who have failed simply because they were just too optimistic or maybe too unrealistic and so on. But then again, we've also had an era of, you know, money being flowing too fast. You know, we've had kind of a drive-by valuations, you know, people just joining rounds without even thinking. So that
happened.
Yeah, I mean, this is, of course, what happens in bubble economies and so on. But yeah, it's been... it's hard to put your finger on to say, like, you know, because of this, you failed, whatever. I would say in some instances, you wonder why people didn't fail and still raise money, but then realize later on they shouldn't have raised money, probably.
Yeah, because the conditions they ended up with or what have you.
Yeah, exactly. And then on M&A side, I think, because I've been involved with that as well, you know, I've seen people turn down deals that they shouldn't have turned down. I mean, that happened to me. We had some big investors who just invested, and 6 weeks later, we got a massive offer, and they didn't want to sell. And unfortunately, they had the veto right, and you know, we should have sold. So you should be very, very, very careful when you say no to an M&A deal. They don't come often, and when they do come, you should try to negotiate from that to get the best possible deal, unless you really want to something huge. I mean, again, it depends. It's very personal, very much case by case, I would say.
Yeah, because there's been some very famous cases of people turning down deals. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is one that's almost always listed the first time anybody mentions it, but he is the exception, isn't he? Not the rule.
Yeah, I mean, he wanted to buy Snap, didn't he, quite early?
I think he was also offered, something like $1 billion for Facebook by Yahoo very early stages, which he turned down and said no to as well, which was, I don't know, unconventional at the time. But
Yes. I think the most famous one where it was absolutely right to say no was probably when Blockbuster offered something like $10 million for Netflix.
Yeah, that was, history's been written by that one, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
but I mean, in most cases, you're saying that saying no to a deal is not the right option.
Well, you should be, if it's your first startup, I would say be very careful, because, you know, if it's your third or fourth and you already have, you know, you're part of the whatever 2-comma club or the 3-comma club, then, you know, it doesn't matter so much, right? But I think in general, I mean, there's, when everybody's asking questions like, what's the rule of thumb or what works, what doesn't work? Everything is case by case. Every company is unique. Every situation is unique. Every sort of economical cycle is unique. So I think it's more of a point of really understanding your situation. Look for advice around you. Ask people who've been there before you say yes or no, rather than saying, here's the template, this is how it works. It doesn't work like that. So.
But listen, talking about templates then, I mean, let's get into what it is about the technical side of doing these deals and the CTO's role through that. Because you mentioned sort of basically two types of deals there, didn't you? You mentioned raising rounds of funding for investment, and you mentioned M&A. How do those two fundamentally differ when you're looking at it from the CTO's chair?
Yeah, so M&A, the mergers and acquisitions, is when you sell your company, basically, majority of your company, just so everybody understands what that means. Raising capital, of course, is typically when you issue new shares, you invite new investors to your company. You might sell some of your existing shares as well, but they differ in kind of the end result. As an investor, you know, that's the beginning of, it's almost like, now you got like, you know, a full tank of gas, but now, you know, now you're on the grid and now you're going to go out and race, right? And going to win the race, hopefully. That's the funding. Whereas the M&A, of course, is very much about, this is the exit. You know, now it's all about finding a good fit. And does this, my technology fit with the buyer's technology? Or if I'm buying a company, how does that fit? So a little bit different. But the preparation, I would say, is very much the same as the CTO. And I think maybe a lot of CTOs that I've worked with have maybe underestimated their role in this process. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you work for a tech company. So if you're this chief technology officer, you should be a kind of a headline person in this transaction. And if you do it well, you can actually increase the valuation, increase the speed, and make it all happen, you know, if you're well prepared. So I think it falls into kind of two areas. One, what I would call a defensive preparation, and one is kind of more like the offensive preparation. And on the defensive side, of course, it's making sure that your house is in order. You know, everything is well documented. You know that all the questions that will come, you're super well prepared for it around security, scalability, business continuation, you know, failover safety, and also things like, you know, maybe compliance. And so on and so forth. All the kind of boring stuff, if you like, that you like to, you need to think is not being boring, but you have to have them there. Tech debt and all those sort of things. Then the more kind of positive things that you also have to be quite good at, I think, is understanding how to explain how this business, how your technology is making the business happening, and how you are kind of using technology, how you're aware of the latest. And I think the role of the CTO has really dramatically changed over the last 24 months, with AI now having its a real kind of springtime. Things are going so fast that as a CTO, you need, of course, to be able to translate that into how do we apply this technology so that we are kind of at the forefront. So I think having both of those sides, so one is more of a kind of explaining the technology, making sure that you are seen as the custodian of it. The other one is more like your visionary side of you. How do you see the future going? How do you make sure that we are, through technology, you know, staying ahead of the pack? So those are the ways I would think about it.
Cool. And you mentioned there about the role of the CTO changing quite a lot with the advent of AI. And I think AI is something we can get into in a little bit. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the role of the CTO when they're not a founder, when the CTO, you know, compared to when the CTO is a founder. Do you think there's a difference there in the way that they should behave? Or do you think a CTO should basically always treat themselves as though they are a founder of the business?
Yeah, I think the latter. I think it should matter. I mean, I would say this, that think of it more as the founding team, right? So you have some original founders. Sometimes if you're a single founder, you might actually go out and kind of date other founders because you need a co-founder. And that could be CTO. So you could be a kind of a business person, the salesperson, but I need somebody CTO. Later on, you might realize that, you know, I need somebody who's kind of more of an operational person or financial CFO or so on. At the end of the day, you know, once you kind of assume that role, if you're not acting as a founder, you know, there's been a little discussion about founder mode kind of thing recently. I think Ray and Y Combinator talked about this. I mean, for me, basically, it's nothing new. It's just being someone who super, you know, cares about the business personally and are totally invested in it, you know. Now, if you're a founder, maybe that becomes more natural. But if you're not that, if you come from the outside in, if you don't assume that kind of role, I don't think you'll enjoy it as much. And then you have to question yourself, you know, should I have the kind of C prefix to my title? So, no, it doesn't matter. I would say it wouldn't matter.
Because I found that very interesting. Because I think from my experience, there has definitely been a different expectation on me from the founders, whether I am a founder myself as a co-founder CTO, or when I've been a late joining CTO, I think there's been a difference of expectation. And I've had to sort of change that expectation myself by saying, no, look, I am actually fully in, I am an executive and I'm a senior member of the team. So I think that's probably a key lesson for some of the CTOs listening who aren't co-founders, is to get stuck in there, forget the ownership aspect and just own the business, basically.
Yeah. I mean, coming back to the topic of fundraising specifically, I would say there's always a worry by investors that, you know, you really are investing in human beings, right? The business might be early stage. You might have customers. You might have product. The elusive product market fit is kind of there, or maybe. And you know what? It's an ultra marathon. And I would say 10, 20% is talent. 80% is grit, right? Anybody who's done kind of like ultra anything, you know, long distance, you know, it's kind of like your willpower. They'll take it. And of course, they look at, well, this person has 5 or 10 or 15, 20% of the business. Of course, they will fight it to the end kind of thing. Whereas, oh, this is just a hired gun who just came in. And of course, that's where you set up ESOPs and stuff like that to sort of carve out, you know, equity and so on. Now, financial gain, I think in most cases, if you look at a successful company, has not because the founders, you know, wanted to get rich. It's because they really had a total conviction over something that they wanted to change and be proud of. They are truly like into it, solving a real problem and wanted to change the world or whatever. I mean, there's a great examples of this, of course, without naming the obvious names. So in that case, you know, if you find yourself being in a startup, I think it goes without saying that you have to be kind of that emotionally. Both your heart and your brain has to be involved. And of course, it makes sense to have equity in the business, of course, as well. But I think for investors, they find it hard to understand that somebody will just work really hard even if they don't own half of the company. But people do if they love it, you know, if they love it and they've got a great team, they're having a lot of fun, they work late, they have pizza, drink coke. That kind of thing is the part of the whole startup scene. Otherwise, they're going to join a corporate somewhere, you know, sit in a lush office and you know, go home at 4 or 5 o'clock. But so, yeah, I don't think it should matter. Maybe it does matter. I don't think it's shit.
That's a good mindset. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to mindset, doesn't it? So I think that's a good start. So let's focus on what it is that the CTO needs to do going into funding then, because I think we've spoken about sort of the defensive aspects of preparation for the funding. You spoke a little bit about the offensive, in other words, basically what's selling the role, selling the future of the technology. But can you go through some of the other things that the CTO needs to take into account and perhaps some examples of where that's been done really well?
Yeah. I mean, there are some due diligence lists. I mean, and we have also a product called Epichago where we actually build some of those kind of questions that allow, you know, it's like a checklist, if you like, just like a, you know, airline captain before you take off, you know, flaps, fuel, all that sort of things, you know, have you closed the door before we take off? So those are lists, you know, lots of them lists. And they're boring, but you have to go through them, basically. But you can make it a lot easier for the Yeah. So for instance, if somebody comes in, it's great if you can actually have also, apart from all those kind of, you know, due diligence questions, make a presentation that would probably be, I would call it like above the waterline and below the waterline presentation. Above the waterline is kind of like the product, right? This is what it does, how it works, and so on. Now, below the waterline is, this is like how we built it, right? This is how extensible technology is. This is how, if it's service-oriented architecture, if it is a bit monolithic because you had to build it fast, whatever, and then you have to explain that. And then you have to explain, well, how are we going to make sure it's become less, you know, clumsy or whatever, hard to maintain. And then also you might want to say like, you know, okay, what's open source? What are dependencies? You know, is there any kind of, you know, are we driving any cogs here? Cost of good sales because we had to pay somebody a royalty or whatever it might be. You might want to talk about if it's agnostic to the cloud provider. Does it have to run on Azure or AWS? Can you move it around? And then now I come into these numbers as well to explain also the show, like, well, if this becomes 10 times bigger, 100 times bigger, what does that mean in terms of running this thing? You know, where does it break? So it's kind of like, think of yourself, if you were to buying a company or if you were to invest in a company, what information would you want to ask? So it's just, you just turn the chairs around, go get on the other side of the table and then understand, listen, how do I make it easy for the audience to understand what we have? And then you can switch.
Yeah. Do you think there's ever an element of hiding what you have at some stages? Because I think when I think the first time I was on the buy side as a CTO, I sort of realized, there's all these things that somebody could be deliberately hiding. So I want to go and try and ferret those out. Do you think there's an element there of trying to anticipate that and being deliberate about it? Or do you think it's a case of just be as honest and open as you can be with, I mean, for example, you mentioned the numbers there, because I presume you're talking about specifically the tech numbers rather than the general company numbers.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, you will be, here's the problem. If you don't open up your kimono completely, like this is us, warts and all, they're going to find out later on anyway. And then you got egg on your face, right? So it's better to control the narrative and say, look, here we have some issues here. There are some areas here where we should maybe have whatever two-factor authentication. We don't. Maybe this area here should have some more, should be architected differently. We haven't, but we're doing it. That way you gain trust, because most professional investors today, I'm talking institutional VCs, so will throw in their own favorite CTO, somebody like yourself, right, Adam? And say, look, do a thorough due diligence. And it goes down to code review, right? And today with AI as well, you can do an AI code review as well. They will very much quickly...
And it can be done so quickly as well, yeah.
Yeah, so there's no point. It's better to reveal it all and say, look, here it is. And by the way, nobody's perfect.
And if it does look perfect, it's a red flag in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah. No, here's the thing. Everybody who's been a startup knows that it's time to market, right? It's time to product, it's time to release, high iteration... That comes with a bit of like, you know, dirty laundry everywhere, right? Yeah, I mean, it does. And that's fine. I mean, going back to the old days, you know, when Netflix went public, I know the guys, you know, some of the founders there, they had to rewrite the whole server, right? Because it didn't scale. They were already public. Oh, my gosh. Now, that would have been in the prospectus, of course. People would have done that. Back in the day, they didn't understand it anyway, right? They went from zero to $200 million, you know, in 12 months or whatever it was. You know, so the numbers looked amazing. But then you can switch it all around a little bit. It's like, okay, fine. So we have these things here. By the way, let me just tell you about what we're doing over here that really is going to move the needle, you know. So you can turn that around and say, okay, fine. Let me now go into kind of visionary mode. Once they are satisfied that, you know, I understand the state of the nation, right? I understand the issues that you have. Okay, let's just switch over now to where we're going to go with this thing, you know. But what I wouldn't recommend is kind of, you know, not revealing that. If you need to rewrite parts of it, you have to tell them, because it's all about trust. Think about this. When you invite investors to your company, it's like you invite them to your table, right, to your family. And how would you feel if you were part of a family, or invited a family, and all of a sudden they told you that we're cannibals, we're going to eat you. No, no good idea. And by the way, you got reps and warranties as well, which basically means you're responsible. You're going to be on the hook. You will personally have to pay the investors if something comes up. This is material, right? Same thing when you sell your company. You also have to be open about these little things. But there are many cases where people have realized afterwards, like, my God, I was totally oversold and so on. And if you're dealing with I would say if you're dealing with a professional VC firm, they need to protect themselves from lawsuits from their limited partners. So they will come after you for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I was working at Palantir when Hewlett-Packard bought Autonomy, which was one of the biggest competitors at the time. And I mean, I think we've probably seen how that's played out over time through the courts, you know, years later, almost a decade later, still playing out with misrepresentations and who lied to who and who misled who.
It's funny. I mean, you mentioned, it was sad now because Mike Lynch died in that, with his daughter in that horrible accident. I actually met him. We were at the same time kind of competing. He had this, he was very early with AI and pattern recognition. We had a system that basically worked more on Boolean logic, kind of deterministic stuff. But we kind of, we met at conferences and stuff like that. I remember him. He was very much of the professor. And I can imagine actually back in the day that what he was doing was kind of magic. People didn't really understand it. So I don't think but I think in this case it was interesting. It was kind of the buyer's responsibility to understand what you're buying. The seller, of course, is you just have to show whatever you have, right? But you can't hide anything. I mean, you know what? Let the conscious guy be your guide kind of thing as a CTO.
And so one of the things you mentioned there is you're sort of switching from telling to selling at a certain point during the narrative. What's your sort of guide? Because I think most CTOs don't think of themselves as really being a salesperson. I mean, you do see the odd sales-oriented CTO who's very good at explaining the technology and basically getting people to eat out of their hands when it comes to this is what I built, this is what we've got. But most CTOs, not that great at selling. It's one of the reasons they sort of stuck on the technology side of it. So what's your sort of advice on that side of it for the average CTO?
Yeah. I mean, the word selling might have a kind of a negative connotation in the sense that people feel that selling means persuading or kind of, you know, pulling the wool over people's eyes. For me, it's more being a good communicator, you know, what we have and what we can do with it. I mean, of course, you can't have a conversation like this without thinking about Elon Musk, who's an engineer. I mean, he's self-confessed like he's got Asperger's, but he's very good at talking about the vision, yeah, right? He's not an excellent speaker, he knows that himself, but he does get people to believe where he's going, and the vision is huge. And as a CTO, you could probably take some leaf out of his book, say like, well, I need to be able to talk about the vision and so on, but it's more talking about it. And if you're passionate about something, you are naturally selling, right? So if you're passionate about, what do I know, fishing or, you know, cycling or passionate about yoga or whatever, as you talk about it, you know, in an animated way, people will get like, wow, that sounds amazing, you know? So I think CTO, the tip will be this is, you know, communicate, practice your communication. You can do it internally and try to turn it into storytelling. So talk about like, you know, in 1 year's time or 3 years, time, we got to do this. Can you imagine? We should be able to do these sort of things. Wow. So, and how are we going to do that? Well, here are some key milestones to get there. So I think this is something which is worth practicing because it's not just for investors or whatever. It's also for when you hire people or when you explain what you're doing to the rest of the organization. So I think it's just a communication skill. And the way to become a better communicator is a practice, right? It's like everything else.
Good. So it's much more about storytelling. And rather than, I guess, rather than making promises, it's just about talking about the facts, but do it in an engaged and animated way then from your perspective.
And if you can do it so that it's not a separate conversation from the company's conversation, no, it is still focused on solving problems. You know, what are the problems we're trying to solve? And the kind of passionate, you know, mission of solving those problems for these customers. Because what does that mean? Well, if we can solve those problems, it means the following benefits, you know, pain will go away. People live a better life. You know, we can spend more time with our families or, you know, we can make more money. We can save money. We can save resources of the earth, whatever it may be. You always have to tie back to that. So it doesn't become like, oh, can you imagine this microprocessor is working even more cycles? Or can you imagine like this AI, you know, crunching even more data? Well, for what purpose? What? You know, so if you can
bring it back to tangible value.
Yeah. One thing which I find interesting is that, you know, when you have earnings calls on NASDAQ, for instance, every quarter, you typically have the CEO will come and talk, right? But if the CEO doesn't speak, who else speaks? Well, it's the CFO who talks, right? And you wonder like, well, why isn't the CTO talking? Well, because people want to know about the numbers, right? What are the numbers? But really, if these are tech companies, what's more interesting, once the numbers you can write, you can read them, is, well, where's the technology going? And that's why it's so interesting when you listen to Elon Musk, because he will talk. He's the CTO of the company, right? He's the CEO and the CTO. that's why it's so interesting and unique, because like tomorrow is like robotaxi day, right? Everybody's like speculating now, what does that mean? It says if you don't believe, if you don't believe in self-drive, you should not be a Tesla shareholder, right? He's talking technology. He's talking about the vision, you know, like he does with SpaceX and Mars. And it's super motivating, I think, for people. It's exciting, right?
So be an exciting... take a leaf out of that book and talk about it more.
Yeah, be an exciting CTO, but don't be a boring one.
So, I mean, Elon Musk is a great example. Have you got examples of when you've been in the deal room where there's been a CTO who's really managed to sort of sell the vision and sell the future of what's been worked on?
Yeah. I mean, one of my co-founders was Safi. He was actually, he started working for me as a developer, and then we started this company spin-off from another company. But he was actually a developer. But he was an amazing entertainer as well. He was a singer and a songwriter. You know, he actually started a band in that company as well. It was fantastic. So he was more a natural sales guy. But he had the CTO title. So he was super instrumental. So I was kind of more like, I have experience. I've been doing this. He was a bit younger. And he came in and basically did exactly what we just talked about. You know, talked about the future. I mean, we had basically invented an alerting system. It says, in the future, you're going to get alerts on everything. You don't have to search for anything. It'll come to you. This was our vision, right? People just loved it. And it has happened, right? Notifications. Although you don't want too much.
We're always drowning in them now.
Yeah, exactly. But we had this kind of slider thing. You could set the rules and so on and so forth. And once also we had a meeting with this Gartner guy, Howard Reisner, who invented business intelligence. And we were a small startup and we met with him. And we had a meeting, and by the end of that meeting, we said, look, you're not going to write about us, are you? I said, no, I will. I said, no, we don't believe you. And then Safi then, my co-founder CTO, stepped up him and made some really funny comments. I said, I could either do this to you or that to you. You know, which one do you want me to do? And it's this, so that people remember us, you know. I mean, a month later, when we were in the Magic Quadrant, right, as a visionary company, which is huge for us. All of a sudden, we exist, right? So,
because that really gets you on the map being on the Magic Quadrant, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then another moment we had, we went to Redmond at Microsoft. Actually, we had a deal with one of the companies that they bought. And we were asked to come up there to show the technology because they were interested in buying the company. And we had another guy who then took the CTO role. He was an excellent guy, fantastic. And he was a great footballer as well. Actually, he played for Newcastle. He was a top player. He used to play with Alan Shearer.
Sportsman, Alan Shearer. Brilliant.
Yeah, fantastic. But he was very timid and very kind of introverted and so on and so forth. And it was very hard. But he gave a lot of information, you know, in this meeting. But he didn't realize that these guys at Microsoft were just taking notes all the time, like, and didn't give anything back. And we're like, oh, my, we had to stop this meeting because they're just taking all of our ideas, you know. So you couldn't read the room, you know what? I had another situation where I was selling a Portuguese company and we were in this meeting in Boston, Massachusetts. And we just talking, and this guy was like, you know, haven't got any university or whatever. He's just like a white hat hacker, you know, sitting in his bedroom. And this was a cybersecurity company. And they've developed this amazing, you know, so-called sinkholes and honeypots to detect botnets all over the world. Absolutely amazing technology. And we sold the company eventually as well. Anyway, I stepped out of the room and one of the guys from the buying company came out to me and said, hang on a second, that guy, he's the smarter guy in the room, isn't he? I says, yeah, so impressive. So I would say he single-handedly sold the company simply by just communicating his knowledge, understanding of everything. He was really good at explaining, even with a Portuguese accent, you know. So that was one of the goals.
And what was the key difference between those two then, between giving away that sort of, the company secrets and selling the company for a good deal?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things kind of like where, and my role in that situation, so in the first situation, I was one of the founders. In the other situation, I was an advisor. So I could like throttle them a little bit and advise them and coach them and say like, don't say this, say that. We went to Intel, for instance, you know, who bought McAfee. So we're sitting in front of the guy who just bought a big Finnish cybersecurity company. And they were arguing back and forth, whatever. I said, like, just give this guy a chance to talk about, you know, these things. And they just sat and listened. And after a while, they realized, wow, this guy, he knows so much more than we. And that was like Intel, right? McAfee. They should know everything about cybersecurity, but they don't. I mean, fantastic moments, you know? So I guess the point is this, that as a CTO, you have to be genuine with what you have, talk about it, explain it, and so on and so forth. But you can also have a bit of attitude. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I Notion Capital is one of my favorite VCs in London. And I don't know who was there who said this thing that we like founders to have, you know, IQ, of course, EQ, and a bit of FQ. Yeah. And the last bit is like, FQ. So you got to be cocky as well, right? You have to be a little bit like, yeah, you know what? This is what I think. This is where I think things are going and so on and so forth. You can listen, but then you have to have your opinion as well. People like personalities as well. You know, you can't be just too bland.
Yeah. And to do that, you really kind of need to be up to date on the trends and news. Don't you to be able to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Confidence comes from knowing, right? How do you know things? Well, we come back to this whole thing again. You make it your job to know things. You hang around forums. You talk to people like yourself, Adam, and you bring all these CTOs together. You want to be there. You want to like rub shoulders with others. I had a situation where we're in a situation once where the CTO says, you know, I know a lot about that company. Yeah, but we're competing with them. Yeah, but I know they don't have what we have. How can you know that? Because I chat to the CTO. What? Yeah, we have these chat rooms or whatever. What, are you talking to the competition? Yeah, but it's okay because we know where they draw the line. Okay, so that's why I know. Don't worry, they don't have it. So it was interesting to see, like, it's almost like a, you know, he went around the enemy line kind of thing to do some wrecking, what's going on over there. But at the same time, he was giving some information to them as well. So it was kind of like giving it. It's almost like the old Cold War, you know, where you have Soviets and American agents kind of meeting in Berlin somewhere in a little dark cafe, exchanging some ideas enough so they both could do their jobs, you know, but not so much that they were basically
not giving away the grand secrets. Yeah. But that must be super powerful when it comes to M&A deals, for example, just knowing which companies to approach, which companies not to approach, and in some ways how to approach them too.
Exactly. I mean, I'm right now in I got a mandate to sell a tech company, an AI company, and we bring the CTOs in kind of like stage two, where we talk about what do we think the thesis is, why should it make sense for you to buy this company. You typically talk to the CPOs, the product people, the strategy, the corp dev people, and then they bring in, you know, the CTO, the gatekeeper, right? And then we bring in our CTO. And the funny thing is that you can immediately tell if they get along, it could be a deal, right? If they don't get along, no. And why is it that they wouldn't get along? Because of these three letters that we've seen over and over again, NIH, right? Not invented here. And it pisses me off so many times when you go to somebody that makes so much sense and the guy says, well, you know what? It isn't Java, whatever, or it isn't, you know, in my favorite, you know, development tool, or it isn't my database. No, we don't work with SQL Server. We work with Mongo, whatever it might be. But some of the religious, almost like technology, you know, dogmatic thinking is stopping the deal from happening. It's almost impossible in those situations, unless somebody from above says, you know what, I don't care, and basically overrides the CTO. Doesn't happen that often, you know?
So therefore, the CTOs do actually hold an immense amount of power at that point in the deal-making then. Because I think one of the things a lot of CTOs feel is that they don't really have much influence over the way the deal goes down. But your point is more that they can have too much influence in some ways if they've got this kind of attitude of you know, this doesn't work.
Absolutely. And I think my advice, you know, if you're a CTO is, do not fall into this not invented here. It's my baby. And, you know, if anything has, you know, if I haven't given birth to it, it's not worth anything. It's a really, really idiotic approach, you know. And but it's a kind of megalomaniac, you know, I'm the best of the world. But it's also kind of a controlling thing that, okay, all of a sudden, if we buy this company, then it means that I'm not the czar anymore of all this technology. No, you are. Even more so if you embrace it, you know, embrace and extend, as Microsoft used to say. So yeah, you want to be part of the solution, you know, you want to look at this and you're probably going to learn as well, even if you know a little bit more.
So it's about taking an open-minded and pragmatic approach to it then, really, rather than thinking about what's compatible, what's not compatible, or don't look for the blockers first.
No, exactly. So you want to look at what tech stacks do they have? What tech stack do we have? Okay, fine. How do we complement each other? Do we have to coexist for a while? Maybe we need to end of life one version. Say if we go together with another company with the same product, of course, it is end of life at some point. This happens, you know, when Microsoft bought Navision, they had Damgar, which became the winner in the end. And Navision slowly fading away. And Great Plains also faded away. And they just went with one. But it actually took 5-6 years before they did that, even more. But if the CTO, then you have to, if you're going to survive and thrive, you need to start thinking about like a business person. Well, what makes most sense, you know? Whether I wrote that code or not, oversaw it. Yeah, you know what? everything comes to an end, right? So it's as a CTO, don't become too in love with your own code kind of thing or your own product.
No, absolutely. I've seen that from the first hand as well, you know, acquiring a company with a totally different tech stack, but where the value just makes sense to a whole bunch of the users. And then, you know, you can work out how to get around those technology hurdles in time, because there is often plenty of time after a deal. You don't have to rush to combine the technologies or achieve the savings. If you're delivering the value, then it makes sense.
I mean, we've seen also, of course, examples of where the acquired company becomes the product, you know, where basically you're retiring your own. I mean, there's a lot of old ERP systems and CRM systems that basically become extremely old hat and they had to buy something else. I mean, it's like a, you know, survival move to buy those companies.
And often at a very good rich valuation when they're bought as well.
Yeah, so I mean, it's but the CTO, again, I think the core thing is as a CTO, you need to kind of find yourself, feel comfortable being a kind of part of the leadership, part of the visionary, part of the, see the whole thing and not get into your kind of, you know, silo of the business and stay there. Because then you are not a CTO, then you are a head of engineering, right? You're not, the CEO is much of a broader thing. You need to really become part of the kind of leadership brain. And if you are, yeah, and if you are, I mean, not everybody wants to be there. This is the thing as well. There's nothing wrong if you say like, I don't want that. I'd like to be in my, well, that's okay. It's just that that's maybe you should aspire to be CTO then. You should be aspire more to be a very strong in a certain discipline of the technology, you know. But I would say this, it's more fun to come up on the top of the mountain, right? To see the whole kind of mountain range than to be down in the valley all the time, right? It's amazing when you're, because then now all of a sudden everything makes sense when you see the whole thing, right? When you're down in the valley, it's like...
I mean, that's absolutely from yours or my perspective. I can see that completely. And those of us who are in the CTO community are often saying the same thing. Look, the CTO role is a business role. You need to be as equally business as you are tech. But I do get your point about that there are plenty of leaders, tech leaders, VP engineering, architects who actually, they think they want to be the CTO because of the title, or maybe even because of, you know, the salary or some other compensation aspects to it. But the job itself, it doesn't suit everybody. It is a business role and it does need to have that wide vision, doesn't it, to make the most out of it.
Exactly. And the other thing that helps you if you want to make the effort to come up a little bit, see the broader view, is that you're like, you will have less classic, you know, West is West and East is East kind of, you know, Kipling arguments about, oh, you guys would just want to sell a product. You don't understand what it needs, what you need to build and how. All of a sudden, you just realize, oh, I realize what we have to sell right now really hard because we're running out of money. Okay, I get it. Now, okay, well, let's me put together something that we can sell this quarter so we can sell our next quarter instead of just digging your heels in and saying, don't sell that because we don't have it. So all of a sudden, you see the whole thing. So it's an eye-opener for many people to sort of like being let into the kind of situation room, you know, to see, oh, and now I see all the arguments. Okay, right. Likewise, for people who are in sales or in marketing to understand that, okay, you know what? If we sign this deal, yeah, we can party, you know, that night and the next few weeks, whatever, we're going to go under because we can't deliver. So we're going to beg on our face. We're going to get lead lawsuits. And so. So it's East and West. Where East and West meeting each other, understanding each other's perspectives, you know. But I think it falls a lot on the CTO to kind of come out of that, you know, typical, whatever, stigma of tech, you know, nerd thing. It come out of that kind of thing, you know. And again, back to the topic of fundraising on M&A, you have to, because if you don't, you know, you are playing your own little kind of isolated game on the side. And that could be potentially kill a deal, you know?
And I think that's something that we've seen over the sort of the last, I don't know, I mean, you've been in business 30, 35 years, almost as long as the CTO role itself has existed. I mean, it's only the sort of mid-1980s when the first CTOs were actually appointed. And I think in that time, as CTOs become more and more important to a deal, and from the current trend, is only going to continue to be more important to a deal, especially with the rise of AI and another shift in the industry, which makes it look like, you know, AI is going to come under the CTO longer term, and it's going to be fairly central to a lot more businesses, judging by the amount of capital that's being poured into it just right now.
Yes, I was interested when you take your sort of broader historical perspective on, you know, where if you look at where the CEOs come from, typically in the US, they come from the sales, you know, sales and marketing, you know, Harvard Business School kind of thing, rather than MIT. If you look in Germany, it's diploma engineers. They come very much from this sort of engineering and they become business leaders. And then in the UK, I guess there's a lot of financials and consultants and they're going to become CEOs. And you can know, I mean, I saw some research that actually showed that, you know, there's a heavy overweight on successful companies being driven by people with a business acumen, you know, who have kind of the business school from the beginning, can sell, right? But if you find the companies who have both the ability to sell and drive the business and have technology knowledge, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems, wow, it beats everything, you know, because now you can have the conversation of, is this good for business? Can we technically do it in one brain? So I think it's interesting to see that when you have kind of like, or you should look at sort of, you know, people who get the Larry Ellison in Oracle, actually, he coded once upon a time, yeah, first database, you know, and then he had Ray Lane next to him. This was like these double acts, you know, and most cases you have these double acts, you know, Tim Cook, you know, with Steve Jobs and so on. It's fantastic when you have it, you know, somebody who really understands the technology, the vision, and somebody really understands the go-to-market, how to sell it, how to sell it to customers, how to sell it to the capital markets, you know, and to people joining the company, creating this kind of aura around it. It's interesting. As one company that I think of as one, I can't remember his name now, but F-Secure, fantastic CTO. Sorry, I can't remember his name now. Ponytail. He did the most amazing TED Talks. And whenever it was a cyber, you know, hack or something like that, he was the guy that people called, and his opinion. He was a very, very vocal CTO. It was fantastic for that company to have somebody like that, that had that technical kind of, you know, authority, but also the ability to communicate and explain what was going on, right?
Yeah, the gravitas and the communication in one person.
Yeah, if you're a CTO, you feel comfortable about, you know, communicating, or you feel like you have the potential, then go for it, you know, and take, you know, claim your position, right, you know, and be part of this fundraisers and M&A and so on and so forth. Don't hide. And practice makes perfect. It really does. You know, I think the more you do it, the more comfortable you feel. So it's coming out of that, you know, little bit of a technology, you know, cage and come out, you know, it's a thing.
And that brings us right found full circle to try and distill everything that we've spoken about down into a playbook that's actually really practical and useful. So I've been taking some notes. So, you know, correct me or re-steer me where I go wrong, but your tips basically come down to whether it's M&A or raising a round of funding, preparation seems to be key. And you said prepare early and be well prepared for an event transaction. Think wide, sort of looking at the whole deal, not just the technology aspects of it, but all of the parts. And that encompasses understanding the strategy. Of course, the strategy should be enabled by tech. That's the reason your CTO is important in the deal. But understand the full strategy of the business and how it works. You then mentioned two aspects to be ready for. One was the defensive side of it. So that's all the due diligence, the questions, the security, and so on. And the other side was the offensive. And that doesn't mean annoying people or pissing them off. It means being able to proactively sell, which is about how does this tech kind of change the world effectively? How is it going to make a difference to everything that's going on from the point of view of this business? I think another tip that I wrote down from what you were saying was quite a good one, which is don't sell, explain. And, you know, be able to explain clearly and unambiguously and translate it into the language that people are used to using. Know your numbers, I think, was another key aspect to being able to sort of say, tell the facts and explain how it is. And you also mentioned as well that, you know, with hosting costs and these kinds of things, a CTO's budget can be a significant part of the overall balance sheet and P&L statement for a company these days.
You know, I just said we see 10, 20, 30% of companies' P&L is the cloud cost, right? And if you're providing a service that we be more efficient, of course, it's on you to make sure that happens, you know, that we can cut those costs.
Yeah. So know the numbers is crucial. NIH. Avoid the NIH, the not invented here syndrome, so that you're open-minded and pragmatic about potential deals and, you know, the technology marriages that are necessary as part of them. And it's something that we didn't really mention that much, but you sort of touched on very briefly, was about, you know, where the future's going. Having a roadmap versus having a sort of an experimental attitude and perspective on things. How does that sort of play into a deal, especially towards essentially looking at the longevity of a deal, or viability of a good deal?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's all about the product, right? You know, you have a product, and where is that product going, and how do people expect that product to evolve over time? Like now, it's kind of really hard. It's hard right now to draw kind of a firm line of exactly where your product should be in year 1 year, 2, 3, and because of the amazing speed of AI. Some people are saying that, you know, classic SaaS products are kind of going to be dead, right? Because you're going to have another kind of UI that will be conversational voice and all that stuff. I'm not totally convinced, but, you know, there are you need to make sure that you say like whatever, it's almost like a scenario planning. So instead of saying, this is our plan for the future because the future is going to be like this, you say, no, we have seen 3 or 4 scenarios that we can envisage. We are prepared for all of those scenarios. So we have an idea. So it's more scenario planning. And you have this exactly. This is the classic situation when you have a lot of turbulence in the world, external factors, geopolitical or finance, you know, interest rates, inflation. You need to build scenarios. Same as the CTO. Start building scenarios where you need to go with the product, depending on whether this takes off or that takes off. And I think, again, you know, you cannot not be involved in strategy as a CTO today in a company. You have to take, you know, if a company doesn't have a strong CTO, I mean, this is a huge weakness that understands where this thing is, stuff is going, can be quick on their feet to adjust. I mean, to be honest, it could be a situation where you might even come up with a plan that says, look, we already have, say, 20, 30 million euros in revenues or dollars. We're doing fine. We have, you know, 1,500 clients and so on. The decision might be to rewrite. Absolutely total rewrite. Wow. What a mega decision. You know, who's going to take that decision? What is it going to be based on? Well, obviously somebody who understands that the earth is shifted on our feet, you know, all the rules have been rewritten, you know, change. I mean, you think about cloud, you think about mobile or the internet itself. This is why I've seen this many times. This time is probably a much bigger kind of, you know, earthquake that we've seen before. And the agile will kind of, you know, win. So I think we are in that situation right now with the CTO. Great CTOs are going to be absolutely pivotal to companies thriving in the future, where we are rewriting the map on how to deliver software and how many teams you need and what kind of skills do you need, all of those sort of things. So, I mean, we are in a kind of a flux situation right now, I feel.
So you really think it's one of those big pivotal moments in literally in the history of computer science then?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, I think. And I'm experiencing myself. I see all the tools. We play a lot with the tools. You know, I run an advisory firm where we basically advise companies. Of course, I get a lot of presentations. I talk to, I don't know, 4 or 5 entrepreneurs every week. We're our own platform, Pichago. We're experimenting with a lot of stuff. And it's mind-boggling, the stuff you can do right now. I mean, it really begs the question of, gosh, you know, where we will be in, not in 10 years' time, like 2 years' time.
Yeah.
And Adam, you've had some fantastic CTO craft meetings where we've also been presented to by people in the know. So question is, if the CTO, it should be the CEO, actually, you know, at this point, or the CEO should like implant some CTO skills. It really is at that point right now. So, you know, if you think about the car industry, there are these 4 mega things that have happened in the last 10 years that made a lot of car companies really wonder whether they will exist. You know, it's the connectivity, of course, it's a self drive, electrification, exactly, and subscription. Should I buy a car? Why should I buy a car? So those things at the same time, boom. And you can imagine then somebody who's been running a whatever German or Italian or, you know, French car company like Yonks is going to like move that quickly to decide. And they have to bring in the techies right into the room. And then you have a techie who basically disrupted the tool for them, right? Who knew nothing about cars. So there's an example. So apply that across every industry right now. So yeah, so if you are a CTO, if you can hone your skills in understanding strategy, you know, follow, read blogs, follow, you know, people who are, you know, under the leaders and apply yourself, you can have an amazing career.
And in preparing for that, because you mentioned Pichago really briefly, and you know, preparing for that and understanding what are the stages that you need to prepare for your next funding round, for your next M&A deal, or even just understand the current valuation of your company. Just tell us a little bit about how Pichago works and what it does for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I meet entrepreneurs. I ask the same questions over and over and over again, right? And I just thought, what if we built a platform that basically have all those questions? And then most of the questions are around maturity. You know, do you have a sales process? You know, do you have a testing process? You know, do you have a process for checking, you know, your scalability or your compliance and so on? There's a lot of things that are to do with how you think about stuff, you know. So we basically looked at 16 areas of the business where technology is one thing, of course, and sales and marketing, finance, storytelling, you know, impact as well, super important, you know, the mega trends, which trends are you riding on right now? So we basically wrote that, and then we provided a kind of a whole host of like ideas on, well, if you're at the level three, how do you get to level four? What are the typical actions you need to take? And then we've applied some AI on top of that to say, well, here's some ideas on how you can get there. So it's kind of a self-assessment, self-help thing that you can do with your team. And if a CTO, you can focus on product. We have product, we have solution, we have technology, you know. And why do we differ between solution and product? Because product is actually what you're delivering. Solution could be much more than that. Could be services around it, you know, the aftermarket, you know, is how
the total value to the customer effectively.
Yeah, exactly. How people, you know, experience your product, sort of thing, you know. So that we've done that, and it's amazing. We have hundreds and hundreds of entrepreneurs, founders, and now also incubators using this. And it's free to a certain degree. We've also now included some investor databases as well, so you can connect with investors. So it's basically, again, for us to think, you know, how can advisory services also be somehow digitized, you know? Although I still believe very much in the human touch. You know, it's having conversations is also where you evolve your thoughts, you know? But we see this thing as well going towards kind of a conversational digital co-founder, you know, so because there's so much knowledge out there. The problem is when you're trying to listen to too many podcasts or read too many books or whatever is you need to translate that into your own context. Okay, fine. I listen to Elon Musk or I listen to Paul Graham or I listen to, you know, Gary V, whatever. How do I take that and make my list of actions?
Distill it down into my playbooks, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this is why I think these kind of applications, we think that they are very useful. It's like when you read a self-help book, at the end of the last chapter is always, now you've got to do the work, right? So you actually have to translate all that inspiration you got into, what am I going to do, right? So it's like a PT, you know, that kind of says, okay, fine, let me help you build a plan on how you're going to get more agile, faster, you know, better conditioning or stronger. So yes, this is
excellent.
Our approach.
Where can people find Pitjago?
So at pitjago.com or pitjago.ai. You'll get to the website and then it's all free. You do assessment, first assessment, 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes. And then after that, you can sign up and dig deep into all the other areas.
Excellent. That's a really good resource that I've taken a couple of companies through that and they've really valued the feedback they get from it in terms of what's next steps and how they can go from there. Thorgeir, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. I know our listeners are walking away with some practical tips and techniques that they can apply to the next funding round or M&A transaction if they get to that stage. And hopefully they'll feel a lot more confident about that as a result of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Adam.
As always, if you found today's episode valuable, don't forget to visit the website, join the CTO Playbook community for more resources and support. And the link will be in the show notes. Until next time, keep innovating and lead with impact. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.